also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on, the Jagera and Turrbal people, and pay my respects to elders past and present. I am going to take you on a whirlwind tour. I've spent the last 10 years learning and working with a range of communities who are really affected by entrenched disadvantage. And so I'm going to share in the spirit of this report, and I have to congratulate CEDA on an excellent report that really, I think, summarises some of the really key tensions that we're facing in this space. And you'll see from some of these learnings that the opportunities for change echo the sorts of issues that were raised in this report. I think what I've learned most is that we actually have the evidence about what works, particularly in place. And that is that we do need good data, but we need the data to be cumulative. We need it not just to be big, but to be thick and deep. We need approaches that are holistic and recognise and respect diversity and flexibility for people and in place. We need to support. We need support that recognises people's strengths and responds with more than more services. Here's another service. And we need investment that focuses on outcomes and is timed accordingly. My fine print down the bottom is that I think one of the biggest issues in this space is that we need to use the data and the evidence to build a business case for actually investing in what works. And we need to use the data and evidence to build a palatable argument that supports political and popular will to actually make that investment. Mobilising data, I think, is one of the key pieces to this puzzle. It's not just big data. It's data that comes from services and from lived experience. And what I've learned in all of these places is that one of the big opportunities that we're not grasping hold of as yet is the importance of data literacy at community level, so that we know what people can actually articulate what the data is saying about those communities and those people. And we need to start talking about who owns the data. Can we have a conversation about governance of data and community ownership of that data? And finally, how do we use the data most effectively to learn what works to create real and lasting outcomes? Just to give you an example, I think we have an awful lot of data out there. In the last 5 years, there's been about 150 reports per annum on place-based disadvantage. We also have a lot of the resources, the money. There's been an increased spend of about 18% per annum on addressing place-based disadvantage. And yet, we're flatlined on making change, particularly in 5 to 9 localities in every state that have consistently been at the lowest decile for the last 20 years. So the question is, what do we do with the data that we've already got? One of the things that's consistently coming up in the communities where we work is that the data usually looks like this. This is data around Greater Dandenong, not in Queensland. Sorry, I've been out of the state for the last 4 years. The data is very focused on deficits. And what people are increasingly telling us is that we need data that also focuses on the strengths, the opportunities and the capabilities that people and places have. This was one of my big lessons in working in some of these disadvantaged communities. Increasingly, we're being asked to help communities to visualise data in a way that reflects a holistic picture of what's happening in those communities, and in ways that the communities can use the data themselves. and they're asking for data that actually explores their assets as well as their deficits. So, for example, if in another place outside Queensland, one of the most disadvantaged corridors in Victoria, or Lane Cario in Geelong, instead we had mountains of data about the deficits. We started looking at what some of the strengths were. In this image, we overlaid CIFA data with data from the ATO that tracked entrepreneurship, people who were registered for GST, and we found an enormous number of entrepreneurs in those communities. The question for us was, what if we focus on entrepreneurship and finding those entrepreneurs? How would that change the welfare debate that we were having in those places? The other part is about reframing the data. So this is statistics I often hear in the community context. This is data from one of the communities where we were working. 100% of young people in this community of a particular cultural cohort were disengaged from education and work. 100%. It was a devastating statistic. So someone asked, how many young people is that? It's 36 young people. We can do something about 36 young people who are disengaged, 100% disengaged from education and work. It's much harder to grapple from an action perspective with 100% than it is with 36 people. One of the other challenges and opportunities, I think, is to raise the bar on the destinations that we're tracking towards and measuring towards. So this is a picture of some of the barriers faced by a young person with multiple complex issues trying to look for work. All of these issues that they faced just before they even got to the idea of finding work, finding a job. Those issues are siloed in terms of who addresses them to such an extent that the young people told us that navigating the system was like living in a bowl of spaghetti. The workers also told us that what they needed was a whole person to navigate the system and find out what was happening in each of these agencies. The opportunity is to zoom out from that picture and say, not only who navigates, who knits these systems together so that that young person cannot have 9 caseworkers, that young person had 9 caseworkers. That's a full-time job. No wonder they didn't have time to get a job. The other thing they told us was that the journey is really long and hard. The current service system is a bit like sitting underneath a bucket of confetti. The average length that someone who's significantly disadvantaged spends in job active is 5 years. The outcome that we're heading towards after that 5 years is a job. So person plus job equals outcomes. In the current job context, in the current market, in the current economy, where does that leave people? What we found was that that leaves people in a continual loop of looping between unemployment, precarious employment, underemployment, and then back to unemployment. 47% of the people who were significantly disadvantaged were to cycle back within a 5-year period. So the question, the opportunity is to raise the bar. What do we mean by outcomes? Yes, we need to evaluate. We need to look for better outcomes. But if those outcomes are setting the bar so that we just turn people around, is that good enough? Can we head towards transformational outcomes so we actually set up design services so that they can look at person plus a quality job plus a living wage plus pathways to address other issues? Is that the outcome we should be destined for? From my perspective, having looked at all of these communities, taking that shift into more transformational outcomes actually helps to strengthen the safety net. And it opens up I don't think we're going to be able to rely on government to hold the ends of safety net themselves. So if we take a transformational outcome approach, some people have asked me, do you really think that businesses are going to come around the table to hold the edge of the safety net? I think they are, because if we look at transformational outcomes work for businesses. They don't just work for people. Transformational outcomes happen when we invest in people, we invest in the businesses that employ those people, and they're interconnected. And increasingly what we're finding is that businesses are prepared to stand up and say, addressing disadvantage is everybody's business. 120 businesses have signed up to Compact in Geelong as part of the Grow Network to share data about where their money is being spent. And their aim is not to all contribute some of that money towards addressing disadvantage, but to actually track where the business of their business is contributing to addressing disadvantage in those most disadvantaged customers. They're aiming towards shifting 7% of their spend so that it flows directly into those postcodes. In South Auckland, the employers in South Auckland have realised that if they increase their wage spend for Maori and Pacifica young people and they participate in the training, $2 an hour will enable them to close the gap between Maori and Pacifica people living in South Auckland and the rest of Auckland. If we don't do that, it will take 25 years to close that gap. What they've done in South Auckland is also to have a look at who plays these roles. Can we create anchor institutions whereby those anchor institutions will support the young people, the businesses, the universities, and draw those people together to address the whole and to start to change the conversation? That's the challenge, that's the opportunity. I look around this room and I see a lot of people who are participating in this conversation, who are making a real difference in their communities, who are taking on some of these opportunities. I think we have a lot more opportunities to harness, and Queensland is a great place to take this conversation to the next level. On that note, I would now like to introduce you to someone who is at the heart of doing some of this work in Logan, Matthew Cox, to come and talk with us